Hi, this is Kashish. Welcome to a new episode of Business Odyssey.
Hello, we are Lakshmi and Laura, partners in the journey of building communities of practice. Thank you for joining us, where we focus on exploring the human-centric approach while we consider all the variables that affect it. From the learning and development, performance, change processes, leadership and coaching, and other key topics as well. Today, we are joined by Anna Miller, a speaker, author, consultant, and work-life balance and work design expert. We talk about how flexible work has been seen in the last couple of years, the connection that has with well-being, inclusion, policies, people, and organizational culture. Happy learning.
Let's go to the interview now.
Hello, sorry. Anna. Yes, please ask me.
Oh, sorry. Hi, Laura. Lovely to join you today on your podcast. And just a little bit about me. I started life in mainstream HR roles and worked for, most jobs are high pressure these days, but worked in really high pressure jobs, mainly in the financial services sector. Began to realise, and this was many years ago, back in the 1990s, that the hours that I was working weren't really compatible with other things, you know, having a life, having a family. So got sidetracked into looking at flexible working and how organisations can use flexible working, improve flexible working. And then along the way, also got involved in a working group of academics who were researching work-life balance, because again, all of that ties in. So now I guess I would say I'm probably the UK's leading expert on flexible working and work-life balance and how those two concepts support employees and employers in the workplace.
Okay, thank you for that introduction, Anna. I had to ask you because I know you wrote a book, and I would love to chat with you about that and your vision regarding those topics and how they combine nowadays, especially in this, I won't call it a sector, but when we talk about specifically about women, what can you share with us about your experience, like actually implementing flexible work across different industries and roles?
Okay, so most of my work with flexible working has been, I haven't done anything inside organisations for the last couple of years, which is one of the reasons why I wanted to write my book, to say, look, you know, this isn't done and dusted. And I think one of the reasons why it's kind of taken a low priority, particularly in the UK, is because we have legislation, and a lot of people are mistakenly thinking that because of legislation, we don't need to take any more active steps to make sure that flexible working is there. But going back a couple of years to when I was working with employers, I wasn't specifically looking at flexible working as a way of helping women. The employers I was working with, and I've worked with local government, I've worked with a couple of charities, I've worked with parts of the media, and their main reason for looking at flexible working was more either because of the inclusivity agenda, because flexible working will obviously support not just women, but it will support people who may themselves have disabilities, for example, who may not be able to work standard patterns, or people who are caring for people with disabilities. So supporting a more inclusive workforce. And also supporting well-being, because when people can work flexibly and they have clear outputs, they can work in times and in ways that suit them, and they can find a balance so that they're not constantly working and so that they're not constantly overworked.
Okay, so let me ask you one thing about that, or maybe a few questions around that. You mentioned the well-being and flexible work. You put that together. So how do you, if we are talking about the impact that flexible work is having right now, in particularly there in the UK, how will you describe it in terms of quality?
Right. Well, In theory, flexible working should support well-being because it should enable people to balance their work with other aspects of their lives. And certainly all the research around work-life balance has shown that when people can do that, when they can walk away from their work, then it does improve their well-being. They focus on something else, they become refreshed, and they are better performers. The reality, unfortunately, at the moment is going in the opposite direction. And it had been doing that even before the pandemic struck. So, for example, before pandemic, a lot of women, a lot of working mothers were asking for flexible working. But what research has shown was that they were actually doing what the researcher called the triple shift. So that they would work in the office till, say, about 3 o'clock. They would go and collect their children from school. So that's the second shift of looking after their children. And then when the children went to bed, they would be working again. So that flexible working was being quite badly managed. And this is not a criticism of individual women, because when they're offered flexibility, they are also often not offered ways to manage that flexibility. And of course, since we've had the pandemic, it's actually got even worse, because for most people, they were living and working in the same space. And with technology enabling access to work 24/7, people have found it harder and harder and harder to switch off. So essentially, for most people, they're losing that boundary between work and non-work. And while in theory it should be supporting their well-being, in reality, for many people, it's having a very negative impact on their well-being.
Okay, I see that. So how do we connect these with mental health, because we're talking about well-being, that nowadays is 100% implemented. How is the impact that is having in mental health in working?
Right.
People?
Well, I think from a mental health perspective, I mean, one of the I'm not a mental health expert, but obviously, one of the things that you want to be able to do is you want to be mindful and present to whatever you're doing. And I know that mindfulness has been shown to have a positive impact on mental health. So if you can be mindfully working or mindfully parenting or mindfully socializing with your friends or whatever it is you're doing, if you can be there in that present moment focusing on one thing, that is good for your mental health. Now, the problem with the lack of boundaries that we have at the moment is that for most people, they end up taking some sort of multitasking approach where your brain is constantly focusing on more than one thing at a time, where you tend to lose the focus on what you're trying to do and where it becomes much more stressful. So encouraging people to set those boundaries where they say, right, okay, I mean, you know, I know if you're a working parent, there are always emergencies, you know, your child's school might call and say, look, you know, there's been an outbreak of measles or something, your child needs to come home. There's always emergencies, but they're rare. And it's the same at work. You know, you might have a sudden emergency, but for the most part, we need better mechanisms to keep those separate bits of our lives separate in the moment so that we can be more present and that we can improve our mental health.
Okay, I see that. So what about if you want to share some examples about the steps that you mentioned in your book. What was the best and what is there to improve?
Right. Okay. Well, in my book, what I've done is I've looked at, from an employer perspective, the three things that employers need to do in order to both support well-being and support flexible working better. And the first step is they really need to get much clearer on supporting work-life balance, because a lot of employers do say, oh yes, you know, work-life balance and well-being are important to us. But then when people try and take control of their own well-being by saying, I want to work flexibly or I want to work reduced hours, they pay penalties for that. They pay penalties in terms of whether they might be promoted, in terms of the way they're perceived by their colleagues and by their managers being less ambitious. And research has also shown that while a lot of employees say, yes, yes, you know, we support flexible working so that you can have a better balance, in the UK at least, only half of employers offer any guidance on how to manage that. So employees are left on their own struggling with, you know, should I be doing it this way? Should I be doing it that way? So that's a very important key step that employers need to take in order to improve employee well-being, is to get much clearer on what work-life balance is and how to manage it. The second step that they need to take is to look at the myriad of barriers, what has been called by some people the glass labyrinth or the glass maze, as opposed to the glass ceiling. The glass maze of things that people who want to work flexibly have to navigate. Meetings that are set up not to accommodate them. As I mentioned earlier, the perception that they're not particularly ambitious. Losing out on training, losing out on important projects. All of those things which should support flexible working, but which in many organisations don't, so that flexible workers are still penalised for the fact they work flexibly. So that's the second thing. The first is about getting clear on their support. The second is about removing those barriers. And the third thing that I would like employers to do is to really look at what's going on under the radar in their organisations for two reasons. Firstly, there are people working flexibly that they don't know about. But secondly, there are a lot of people, women in particular, making decisions on the basis that they don't think they can get the flexible working that they want. So, for example, I have come across a lot of mothers returning to work who then move themselves onto what the Americans call the mummy track. So back office jobs, jobs that are not going to lead to promotion, sometimes even a demotion in responsibility. And they do that because they cannot see how they can make a full-time high pressure job work alongside their family responsibilities. And I've also found that in many organisations, what employers tend to do is say, oh, but she chose to do that. Oh, but that was her decision, without exploring, well, why was that her decision? If that choice is the only choice she has, then really she has no choice at all. And I would really like employers to hear that, to understand that. And when those choices are made, to say, is this really a choice? Or is it that our culture currently is pushing her into the only choice that she can make?
Mm-hmm. I see that. so I have a couple of questions right now regarding those steps. How do we get the awareness within the organization about what is and what it takes to be in or move forward from an organization that don't have flexible work, don't have well-being and mental health policies, to one that actually does it?
So. Well, funny you should ask, because I did do some research with organisations in the city. It was about 10 years ago now, but there is a model, and I was exploring the model. It's a model developed by the Families and Work Institute in New York, and it looks at how an organisation progresses to being an employer that fully embraces work-life balance. And the first stage is obviously is awareness of the need for that, flexibility and other support. The second stage is to put in the policies. And that's where a lot of organisations go, right, that's it, we've done it. And a lot of organisations are still at the policy stage, although some are now beginning to make progress. The third stage is what they call when the hearts and minds have been won. And that's the point where both the managers, the senior leaders and everybody in the organisation fully understands and fully supports the benefit of flexible working, of how it supports work-life balance, of how it supports good well-being. And then they can move forward and fully implement that. The culture has been changed. And what my research found was that the way to do that is to start the conversations. So it has to be a strategic approach from somebody who has responsibility for that to start talking about what are we doing? I was talking earlier about looking under the radar. So maybe asking questions about what are we currently doing in terms of flexible working? And how could we do it better? How would it benefit us if we did do that? And in many organizations, there are people who can make fantastic role models. Often, you know, not many, but two or three people at senior levels who have got some sort of flexible arrangement, but they're keeping it quiet at the moment because it's not the organizational culture. When you start opening those role models up into the organization, talking about what they're doing and how they're doing it, the interest opens up and people begin to start saying, well, how could we do it here? How could we do it in this part of the organization? And for me, I think it's very important that organizations harness all that stuff that's going on internally, because that is their best proof that it can work. There's no point someone like me coming in from outside and saying, here's what worked for another organization, because they will immediately say, ah, oh, but it's different here. So it's about understanding their own culture and then taking those steps, having those open conversations that lead the organization towards more flexibility. And obviously that has to be a strategic and a managed process.
Mm-hmm. I see that. So when it's come to this, I mean, the third steps that you mentioned, and I was hearing you what you said, and you mentioned a key word that is organizational culture. So if I understand that correctly, organizational culture plays a key role when we are talking about flexible and well-being as well, right?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
So,
sorry, go on.
Yes, because I would like to understand based on that, how can we, the senior leaders or a manager or just whoever takes responsibility for it to speak up, for asking not the right question, but asking if they are doing that because of what, why they are doing that. Is this the right decision? Is that the only option that these working moms had? So how do we measure the impact, or how do we minimize the risk or improve our chance that those questions can be asked in a culture that usually don't speak up? I hope my question, because I'm thinking, yes. I'm talking, so I hope my question understand, yeah.
Absolutely.
Please.
Yeah, I mean, it's a big question, Laura, and I'm going to answer it in two parts.
Okay,
and the first part of it is the actual, you know, what's going on with the culture. And the big problem with the culture, and you know, this has been identified by researchers, you know, going back quite a long time now, people have written books about it, even the media have picked up on it, is that organizational cultures have been designed by men for men. And that was because up until about the 1960s, predominantly the model was that men went out to work, women stayed at home and did all the other, you know, life support stuff. So working arrangements were designed on the basis of what suited or what was most appropriate for the men. And even now, as you move into very senior levels, if you look at people in very senior levels in organizations, that is often still the model where you get a man who is working and a wife who isn't, who is still at home doing life support. So one of the big challenges is still saying, right, okay, you know, organizations, many of them still work on a culture of work designed by men for men. And I keep saying, you know, 20th century working practices don't fit 21st century lives. So with women working, with 50% of the workforce being women who have different responsibilities, different outlooks, how are we going to change that, which will benefit both men and women? So that's the first thing, is about looking at the underlying culture. But the second thing is, I think, you know, on a more practical level, it's looking particularly at what happens. I don't know what it's like in Argentina. I suspect it's similar in many parts of the world. I certainly found it was when I looked at the research for my book, that particularly in English speaking areas like America and Australia, it tends to be quite similar, that when you look at the figures, the fall off, the loss of women comes at the middle manager point where they're about to move into senior roles. And it happens in a number of ways. They will put themselves onto what's called the mommy track. They might drop out altogether, or they might say, right, I'm going to leave this job and find something a little bit less senior on a part-time basis where somebody else will offer it to me. So, for an organization, they ought to be, rather than just looking at that and saying, right, okay, so, you know, women are leaving, well, that's understandable, they have a family, they want to combine it with this or that, or, you know, rather than taking the first face value reason that's given, it's about getting under that and saying, what is the real reason? And very often when I speak to women, they will say, well, yeah, we have a flexible working policy, but my individual manager won't let me work flexibly, or in order to work flexibly, I'll have to take a step down to a more junior job or whatever. So the first aspect is the cultural aspect, but the second aspect, which, you know, obviously is part of culture as well, because culturally it's not seen that you can work flexibly at senior levels, but it's also it can be researched very practically. You can even pop a couple of questions into your annual employee engagement or employee survey if you run one that actually say, do you believe the culture in this organization supports flexible working at senior levels? If you had the opportunity, would you work more flexibly? Questions like that. So mm-hmm. there are practical steps that employers can take, but very often, as I say, they don't dig deep enough. They just say, right, well, you know, that's just her choice. That's just the way she chose to manage her career.
Mm-hmm. I see. So I have two main questions right now. Actually, what's the understanding? What's the common sense, or how can we define flexible work if we have an understanding of it? And how does flexible work connect with inclusion, well-being, and mental health?
Yeah, that's interesting. I mean, it particularly the kind of the flexible work. What is flexible work? I as I say, I've been working in this area for about 25 years. So I remember, you know, about 10 years ago, I would write info packs for employers that would say, and here are the flexible working possibilities. you can have. And it would be, you know, you can work full time to flexible hours, you can work part time, you can work job share, you can work remotely, you can work term time, you know. So it would be kind of listing specifics. And while that kind of helps people with their thinking, what it doesn't do, particularly in some of the complex workplaces that we have at the moment, is it doesn't enable people to be creative. So what I prefer to say now that is that if you were looking at truly flexible work in your team, then you would be looking at what are the outputs that we need to produce and to what time scale, and how do the individual team members need to depend on each other to do that. So from that, an individual team can then work out the flexible arrangements that would be best for them. And it could be that for some, that means, you know, working in the evenings because that suits them. It could be for some, that means working part of the week. It could be that for some actually want to work standard hours because they want that boundary there. But it stimulates a different conversation. So and again, it's interesting this because right at the moment in the UK, we have something going on, which is the 4-day working week experiment. Mm-hmm, and while working 4 days a week can be interesting, can be sorry, useful for some people, it doesn't necessarily, for example, help people who may have childcare that is based around 5 days a week and they still have to pay for the fifth day. So, you know, it's not necessarily, by defining it narrowly, we risk excluding people. If we define it broadly and then treat people as grown-ups and say, right, as a team, how would it look if it was working well? Then we give people more options. So that's, you know, the definition of flexible working. Mm-hmm. And then how it ties in. Well, obviously, we've talked about the some of the aspects of well-being. The work-life balance research, in fact, the psychological research, talks about people having finite resources. So in a workplace context, I have a certain number of emotional resources. It could be creativity, it could be energy, you know, but we have these resources that we expend when we're working. And if we don't then stop, take a break and focus on something else that uses different resources, then we never replenish those resources. So allowing good flexibility that supports a balanced life means that people come back to work more replenished. So obviously their physical and their mental well-being is improved. Mm-hmm. And then in terms of the diversity agenda, obviously my interest is particularly in supporting women. And as I say, my book just makes, you know, it gives so many facts about why women drop out because they don't get that flexible working. Mm-hmm. So that's a big area of diversity lost. But also there will be people with other aspects of diversity that, as I say, you know, they may themselves be disabled and therefore want to work a different pattern that fits in with their disability. They may, for personal reasons, you know, because of the way that their own lifestyle, want to work particular arrangements. So by extending flexibility to everybody across the organisation and at all levels, it can support the diversity and inclusion agenda as well.
Mm-hmm. I see. So I was thinking about what you were saying, and then basically, what is flexible work? If we understand that, is a common agreement or a common decisions between peoples that will work as team within an organization, and how they define that is best for them. Mm-hmm. To have quality results in a mm-hmm. timely manner, to deliver value to the to their customers as well as the organization.
Absolutely, and I think I think honestly, Laura, we have to go to that kind of team manager individual level, because it comes down so much to the job role that you're doing, to the nature of the work that you're doing, that to try and impose something on people doesn't really work.
Mm-hmm. So my point with that is that is it's an how do I say this? I forgot the word right now, but it's not it's a flexible, or it's a concept, it's a definition that is evolving, and based on what's each individual and what's the teams understand about what is best for them. And in the meantime, what the organization can provide them to actually do that kind of flexible work. That's my point, that the concept is in movement, in permanent movement, and is evolving all the time based on that people.
Well, I mean, it is, I agree with you, but I think, I mean, there are some common standards and there are some common things that people can do. And I mean, one of the things that supporting truly flexible working requires is that HR takes on this agenda of supporting managers to understand how to restructure jobs. And there are ways that jobs can be restructured, either, you know, sort of top down by the manager deciding, or bottom up by employees having some participation in the restructure of those jobs. And quite honestly, I mean, this is a 21st century challenge that is not just around flexible working, because the more we see AI, artificial intelligence, being woven into people's work, the more we're going to be thinking about how do we restructure jobs to accommodate that. So my argument there would be, well, if you've got to restructure jobs anyway, why not also think about restructuring them in the best way to support well-being and inclusion and people's performance at work? But you can't just expect a manager or an individual employee to have all those skills straight off. That is an initiative that has to come from HR, who traditionally would be involved in job design and redesign anyway, particularly at the point of recruitment.
Mm-hmm, I see. So from my perspective, or from my knowledge, I see that, okay, let's do that from taking into account the big picture. Let's include all these areas when redesigning jobs to get the people improve while they're doing their job.
Yeah.
I see that. I have the big picture chip in my head. That's why. So... if you had to summarize, what are your key learnings regarding flexible work and well-being and all that we have been talking about, and of course your experience, what would you say?
Okay, well, I mean, obviously what I would say to people is read my book, because, you know, that's why I wrote it.
I have on the list to read that. I have two books to finish before that.
But there's an awful lot of chatter out there. There's an awful lot of opinion. And I think there are a number of things that we need to cut through. First of all, we need to accept that to change the way people work is going to take more than policies. And, you know, this is why right at the moment we've got these big media conversations going on about how women in particular seem to be taking a backward step, because we need culture change, and we need it to be strategic. it's no good saying, well, we have one person working flexibly here, we have a policy over there. We need something strategic. And I think if I were to say one thing, particularly to the HR community or to employers in general, is to fully commit to this. If you believe in the benefits of it, you need a strategic approach and you need someone to own it. And that that would be my message to employers. To individuals, again, I would say, you know, read my book, because it gives you some insights and some steps as to how you can think about the way you play your different roles. So the work-life balance researchers, again, talk often about role conflict, the conflict between work roles and other roles, parenting roles, caring roles. And again, you know, there's a lot of sort of popular opinion out there about what should be done, but very little of it is evidence-based. And that's what I try to do in writing my book, is to give people evidence that they can use in their own lives to improve their own circumstances in ways that work for them.
Thank you, Anna, for that. So if you, I mean, I have two more questions for you, but I believe those are easy to answer. So the first one is, where do people can find your book? And the second one is, where do people can reach you out?
Right, thank you. Yes, I mean, the first one, the book is easy because it is actually on Amazon. And as I was saying to somebody else the other day, when your book goes on Amazon, they decide how much it's going to cost. And they keep dropping the price of my book. So now it's a real bargain. And for the price of a cup of coffee and a sandwich, you could probably get my book and, you know, improve your life. So thank you, Amazon. So that's easy. And the second one is, my website is sustainableworking.co.uk. It's a bit of a mouthful, but if you don't want to go looking for my website, you can find me on LinkedIn, connect with me on LinkedIn, or find me on Twitter. I also tweet around issues around work-life balance. So, out in the social media as well.
Great. Thank you, Anna, for this lovely conversation. I enjoy having it.
Thank you, Laura. Thank you for your time.
Thank you to you, and see you next time.
Thank you. Bye.
Thanks to everyone who makes these podcasts possible. In particular, thanks to the guest speakers and to you who are on the other side listening. If you liked it and were able to learn something new today, we invite you to share it with your entire network. We also invite you to subscribe to our different channels to follow our latest news. If you are interested in being part of these series, you can apply by clicking on the link that is in the general presentation of the podcast. Until next time.
Special thanks to the boys, Kashis Wadbani.